This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Later in the hour, what's left behind when a home burns down? We'll get into the chemistry of it. Plus, what researchers are finding in samples from the asteroid Bennu. But first, this week, according to the USDA and the World Organization for Animal Health, a different strain of bird flu has turned up in the U.S., H5N9. It caused a November outbreak of a highly pathogenic avian influenza on a California duck farm. The dominant bird flu strain currently circulating, H5N1, has led to massive culling of bird flocks worldwide and is now affecting dairy cattle. The U.S. reported its first human death from H5N1 bird flu earlier this month. Joining me now to talk about this and other stories from the week in science is SciFry's Charles Berquist. Hi, Charles.
Hey, Flora.
So a new kind of bird flu, huh?
Yeah, I mean, this gets a little bit weedy, but when we talk about different kinds of flu, there's like the super big level. First, what type of influenza? A, B, C, D. A and B are the kinds of flu you think about when we talk about people getting affected with seasonal flu.
Okay.
C is a kind that can affect people, but it's usually mild. D is mainly a cattle thing.
Okay.
All of the viruses we're talking about here with the bird flu are flu A. But then you get into these H and N designations. That talks about what specific form of two proteins called hemagglutinin and neuraminidase are on the surface of the virus. Then there can be even like finer distinctions called clades, subclades. But what we're talking about here is influenza A, H5N9, as opposed to influenza A, H5N1, which is what's been mainly affecting bird flocks. So we're looking at a difference in the neuraminidase protein.
Do we know where the strain came from?
So this could have been brought in from somewhere else or another animal host, but viruses have this weird ability called reassortment. If you have a host that gets infected with a couple of different viruses at the same time, sometimes the viruses can actually swap bits of code. I think of it like if you have enough kids at the birthday party, sooner or later, somebody's going to be wearing somebody else's socks.
I've lived it, Charles.
Exactly, right? whose socks are these? This new one was found in a duck farm. And ducks are thought to be pretty resistant to the bird flu. It turns out they can be infected without getting very sick, and they just sort of carry the flu around. So a duck farm like this, where this outbreak occurred, can be a good place for that kind of mixing and matching reassortment process to happen and create new viruses.
Should we be concerned?
So officials say that this specific H5N9 virus doesn't look like it poses an immediate threat to humans. But having more kinds of viruses spreading around in animal reservoirs just sort of ups the chance of it making the jump to another species. Also ups the chance of it mutating into something more threatening. So, you know, this is definitely something to keep an eye on.
Let's move on to another microorganism story. There was a spacewalk on Thursday that involved microbes. Tell me about it.
Right. Thursday, there was this multi-hour spacewalk from the International Space Station. This was Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore. They're the two astronauts that have been having an unexpectedly extended stay on the ISS. They were the ones who went up on that Boeing Starliner craft that had had thruster problems. Mm-hmm. So they've been up on the ISS for a while. It's nice they finally were able to get outside for a bit of EVA and look around.
Fresh air.
Fresh air in the spacesuits. They spent over 5 hours outside on Thursday, and mostly they were working to remove a failed piece of communications equipment that needed some repair. Apparently, this was a bit stuck in place. Wilmore said he had to jiggle to get it to come out. But while they were out there, they also took swabs of the outside of the U.S. portions of the ISS looking for bacteria.
Why?
So, you know, stuff is clean when it's set up into orbit. Sterilization's a big deal in the spaceflight world. But humans aren't clean. And the ISS has been in orbit for a long time. They were mainly swabbing around exterior vents from the life support system. And there are other chances for microbes to move around. Say, like, an astronaut touches a spacesuit or tool inside the ISS and then goes outside and uses that spacesuit or tool. There's a chance for bacteria to make the transfer.
And why do they care whether there's a microbe on the outside of the ISS or not?
Yeah, so, you know, the Russian crew has done similar swab studies before. This is the first one on the U.S. side. And the question here is whether or not any bacteria that made it outside could survive on the outside. Because, you know, if there are bacteria that could survive on the outside of the station, you're in vacuum, you're exposed to solar radiation. First, that has implications for finding life elsewhere. You know, what can a bacteria really take and still be viable? It also would raise questions about what we would have to do to protect other worlds from being contaminated with our own life.
Right. If microbes can survive the vacuum of space, we got to be even cleaner than we already are.
Exactly. Just wiping it with the bleach wipe isn't good enough.
While we're on the subject of human bodies, there's new research into itching and scratching.
Yeah. You know, when you have an itch, it can feel really, really satisfying to scratch it, right?
Sure.
But at the same time, that scratching is not good for your skin. If it gets out of hand, you scratch too much, it can lead to more damage and inflammation, which makes you uncomfortable, which makes you want to scratch more. And dermatologists call this the itch-scratch cycle. But that thing of scratching an itch feeling good has kind of been a bit of a mystery. If it's just a damaging thing, you'd think that we would have evolved not to enjoy scratching.
Right, right. It's a paradox.
Yeah. But this week in the journal Science, researchers report that apparently, at least in mice, scratching can also boost immune defenses against bacterial infections right at that injury site. So there's actually some benefit to scratching.
Okay, okay. It sounds like we scratched the itch on that mystery.
Yeah.
Well, what's it good for? Why are people researching this?
So they say that this new immune response pathway might be something that they could target with a drug. So that may be a benefit there. There are also people with a chronic itch condition. They always are itchy. And learning more about why we scratch could potentially lead to hopefully some kind of relief for them.
Let's move on to something that makes me feel itchy sometimes, artificial intelligence. It has been a busy week.
Yes. It seems like every other minute some company is announcing a new revision to their AI model. It's more accurate, it's faster, it's more realistic. Late last week, a Chinese company made big news with this model called DeepSeek R1. And then later this week, the Chinese mega company Alibaba announced its own updated AI model that it said is even better than that.
What was up with DeepSeek?
Yeah, so the big thing here is that all AI systems take a lot of computing power, like a lot of computing power. And the DeepSeek and Alibaba products both apparently have come up with ways to be much more efficient, training and giving results with a lot less computing power and so less cost. And, you know, this was to the point that when DeepSeek demonstrated this R1 model, the stocks of the computer company NVIDIA and a few other companies had significant drops, because if these models hold up, maybe the high-powered computer processors these companies make are going to be less in demand.
Okay, besides the stock hit, why else do we care? You know, why do we care that there's another AI company pushing a new technique or model?
Yeah, so there's all different layers of drama here. So some people are worried that this represents a shift in AI leadership away from the U.S., which, you know, true, it might be. But then there are other complaints similar to the ones that you see centered around the media app TikTok. You know, if you use this model, you're sharing all your data with China, potentially its government. Who knows what happens then? And then to add on to all of that, OpenAI, those are the ChatGPT folks, are complaining that DeepSeek may have copied some of its work or trained its model on ChatGPT output, which is somewhat ironic given the concerns over these models training on data around the web and books and art without necessarily getting permission from the creators in the first place.
It's a pot kettle situation.
Exactly.
This all sounds very messy.
Yeah, messy is definitely a good word for it. We should also note that a lot of these models from the private commercial companies, you know, they're kind of black boxes. We don't see the code. We don't see what it's doing in there. So we really only have the company's claims on some of these efficiency measures. So, yeah, we're going to really have to see how this all shakes out. And on top of that, there's probably going to be something new next week and the week after that. It's sloppy out there.
I think that leads right to our last story. Ancient vomit is in the news this week. I would like to hear every single detail.
Yes. So, you know, this is a story about a fossil hunter discovering what is apparently fossilized 66 million year old fish vomit. This is from a sample in Denmark, and the fossil hunter found what looked like a bunch of mixed up bits of fossilized sea lilies embedded in a piece of chalk. These sea lilies apparently have a bunch of calcium-rich parts that are not particularly digestible. So something, probably a fish, chowed down on a bunch of lilies and then yacked up the bits it couldn't digest. And now fast forward 66 million years and it's going to be in a museum.
Sea lilies were found in there? What is that?
Yeah, so don't think of like lilies like frogs sitting on a lily pad. Sea lilies are actually crinoids. They're these delicate, almost feathery looking things that live at the bottom of the sea. And the thought is that in the Cretaceous, these were a tasty meal for some fish, but just couldn't stomach some of the harder parts of the lilies. This sounds goofy, like why do we care? But fossils like this can give a better idea of sort of the food chain in some of these early situations where tracing out who ate what is kind of an important thing to know.
And probably hard to figure out without ancient vomit.
Right. We have so many gaps that any clues like this are helpful.
What does it look like?
Well, I mean, first it's embedded in chalk. So this is all sort of a beigeish white stuff. And there are cylindrical chunks kind of jumbled up next to each other.
Chunks. That
chunks.
Makes sense.
Exactly.
That adds up.
Yeah. And I know that you like fun words. So just as fossilized dung has a name, coprolite, fossilized vomit apparently has the delightful name of regurgitolite.
Regurgitolite?
Regurgitolite. And now you know.
I am so glad to know that. Charles Berquist, Science Friday's senior producer. When we come back, the toxic substances left behind by LA's fires.
It's definitely an open question in terms of how much cleanup, how deep of a cleanup, how often should you keep cleaning up until you can feel safe again in your home.
We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. After nearly 4 weeks of burning, the fires in Los Angeles are almost fully contained and cleanup is underway. But as the dust literally settles, people in LA are left with questions. Like, what is in that ash coating my backyard? What's in the air? And how do I stay safe? Today, we've got two experts in public health and toxic substance exposure on the line to talk about the chemicals left behind after an urban fire, how much is known, and what science really needs to be done in order to understand this problem. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Rima Haber, Associate Professor of Environmental Health and Spatial Sciences at the University of Southern California in LA, and Dr. Mark Wilson, Director of Exposure Science at the Chemical Insights Research Institute in Marietta, Georgia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Rima, give me a sense of what's happening in LA right now. Where are we with the cleanup process?
We are now at the point where people are starting to go back to their homes. Some of them have been cleared through what we call phase one. Others are still waiting. But the cleanup hasn't really kind of finished yet. I would say it's not even maybe halfway. It's massive and like the scale is unprecedented. So there's so many questions people are having right now.
I mean, is it safe for people to go back to burned structures?
I think that's what we're all struggling to answer as accurately and as kind of in the most helpful way as possible. You know, a burned structure obviously is very dangerous, and I'd love to hear Mark's thoughts on that. But where we're struggling the most is many people are going back to not so damaged structures, but that have a lot of ash outside and around them and perhaps in them and, you know, got a lot of smoke damage. And even when you clean that up, you have a lot of lingering questions around what's possibly safe or not, even in the longer term.
Yeah, I agree with that. It is very difficult to understand just what safe means, given the vast differences in level of impact that are going to be experienced at different locations. And there are very significant unknowns associated with what chemical hazards as well as physical hazards exist within the residual materials and how those may be trafficked in the environment and how they may ultimately impact health.
Well, what are some of those unknowns specifically?
The nature of the residues is heavily influenced by the fuels, the combustion fuels that were associated with the event. And those can vary widely from location to location, even residence to residence. So things like age of properties can be important covariates associated with whether you are likely to see things like heavy metals from legacy building materials like lead in paint or lead service lines in water versus newer residences, which may have things like solar panels and power walls and e-vehicles. So it's very difficult to have a broad understanding of what types of hazards you anticipate being present.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think it's exactly what Mark said. And also, let's say asbestos, which, you know, we know that might not travel too far, but it's so hard to know given how complex the plumes were, how windy things have been. But also, you know, we are worried about kind of what we call multimedia exposures now to people going back. So let's say some of the really open questions are exactly what Mark said, like how much of that is remaining inside my home or right outside. Lead and asbestos are particularly concerning, especially if you have kids who like to play on the floor and, you know, get their hands in their mouth or track in the outdoor dust and dirt. But also even for the smoke itself, we know that a lot of these kind of volatile compounds, you know, tend to like glue themselves onto surfaces and will take a lot of time to start off-gassing and stay in the air even after you clean up. I'm not saying that is maybe the most scary thing or concerning thing right now, but it's definitely an open question in terms of how much cleanup, how deep of a cleanup, how often should you keep cleaning up until you can feel safe again in your home.
So you're saying that even if you've cleaned up all the ash, there could be small volatile organic compounds that are stuck in your couch or that could sort of re-off gas. Is that right?
100%. 100%. And I, you know, we've been talking about this a lot, and I worry that sometimes we're making people panic about every little thing that could be there. I'm not saying those VOCs are maybe my biggest worry relative to lead and asbestos, right? And the things that Mark mentioned, especially with these newer materials, we're not sure exactly what's in them. But all of these are still open questions, and we're trying hard, you know, especially in our exposure science community, like Mark and I are specialized, to kind of get people more actionable information and answers. Like, how do you figure these things out?
Well, what kind of chemical monitoring is happening right now in Los Angeles?
We're trying to deploy a lot of air sensors and monitors. Right now, the air quality is much better, to be honest, but also sometimes the ash gets kicked around. We're trying to measure more of the chemical species within the particles and the gases and volatile organics in the air. But we're also trying very hard to deploy into homes to measure what's in the dust and the soil, especially like ash impacts or remaining kind of air contamination, water contamination. The tricky part is these are, you know, very intensive, very complicated studies, and they need so many things to line up together to be able to do them. So we're not fully out there yet, but we're working very hard around the clock to try to do that.
Let's talk about air quality a little bit, because I know this is on people's minds. I want to play a question from one of our LA listeners.
Hi, my name is Sandon Totten, and I live in Los Angeles, California. A lot of what I'm scared about and wondering about is, like, you know, there's these particles we've heard we can't really measure, things like asbestos or benzene, and how much of that is in the air? Like, should I be wearing a mask when I go outside? And I've heard N95s don't quite catch all the smaller particles, so, you know, should it be full-fledged gas mask, like a P100? You know, it feels like that really is post-apocalyptic. I also have a young child. He's 4 years old. And I don't know, should I be keeping him indoors? When will we know it's safe to let them run around and take, you know, big, healthy gulps of air again?
Mark, any thoughts?
I think it's important to recognize that the caller brought up two distinct classes of hazards. They brought up benzene, which would be a volatile organic, which we were just talking about, and also asbestos. If you were going to use something like a N95 respirator, that might provide a good level of protection associated with something like particles or fibers like asbestos. But depending on the type of respirator, like in the absence of a VOC cartridge, wouldn't provide any protection at all for gases. So until we have a better understanding of kind of the holistic picture of what the chemical hazard landscape looks like, both in the air and in soils and water and dusts, it's going to be very difficult to make definitive statements associated with safety.
Mark, would you be wearing an N95 or a more heavy-duty respirator if you were in LA right now?
If I was personally there, yes, I would wear respiratory protection. I would focus a lot on hygiene, so hand washing and things like that. I would certainly consider if I was going to interact with any kind of impacted area that I would want to probably wear disposable gloves, closed-toed shoes, long pants, long-sleeve shirt. But we also have to acknowledge that the personal protective equipment has to be appropriate for the hazards. And when we don't have a real clear picture of what those are, it's difficult to identify exactly what level of protection is necessary.
Rima?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, Mark. I think I just want to make a couple of clarifications because we're also getting a lot of these questions. So I think Sandin was our caller's name. And basically, like, I'm in LA right now. I'm going around as normal, not wearing anything. In general, day-to-day life, not in impacted areas, right? But there is a distinction. When the fires were burning, of course, we're worried because all these things are being emitted very quickly and in large volumes, right? So I would wear protection if I'm going outside, or at least I would consider it if you're in the general LA area and not very close to the burn or very adjacent to it or downwind of the smoke. But right now, I think if you are going into impacted areas, like Mark said, or trying to clean up your house, or, you know, you were very close to it or in the middle of it, that's when I would wear protection for sure. And exactly like Mark said, right? I do think another important thing that Sandin, our caller, mentioned is their child, who's 4 years old. And with children, we worry more, of course, because they're in such a sensitive developmental stage of their life. And the kind of the open questions we have now are, you know, if they're out playing in a sandbox or on the playground. And yes, there's a little bit of lead that kind of deposited at one of these events, perhaps ash and asbestos. How much cleanup should happen to make sure they are safe? The really important question is sort of how much deposited on the surfaces that the kids are playing in, especially when it comes to lead and ash and metals and asbestos. So, you know, just keep in mind that lots of open questions, but still, as Mark said, if the air quality is good outside and you're not right in the zone, you're probably fine.
Did these air quality indices pick up on some of these other chemicals that Sandin and that we've mentioned? I mean, if you look at AQI, like, is it actually going to give you a picture of whether the air is safe?
So here's the thing. I think people are kind of doing unfair comparisons with the AQI because the AQI was designed as a communication tool, you know, and it's done so much public health good and benefit. The AQI can only use information that we measure regularly, and that's, you know, particles and maybe NO2 and ozone, depending on what's around. We don't have measurements of VOCs and these toxics as regularly and as intensively as some of these other things. That said, the AQI is still a very good indication of whether, you know, you should be worried, yes or no, and it should help you plan your life. But also your nose can tell you a lot if you're smelling smoke, you know, or seeing smoke and ash.
Rima, what long-term health effects are you concerned about?
So there's mental health effects, of course, and trauma from the entire disaster. But, you know, we worry about cancer effects because some of these toxics are more hazardous than your average particle. We worry about cardiovascular effects, longer-term respiratory effects. You know, ash is very irritating as it is, let alone now with all these urban fires, like Mark was explaining. You know, we don't know what kind of damage that could have caused. So this is, again, not to alarm people, but when you look at like an entire community that was exposed over the long term across all these people, we definitely, you know, will be monitoring to see what the chronic health outcomes will be.
Mark, we've talked a lot about how there are so many unknowns right now. You know, if we wanted to understand fires and chemical exposure on a scale like this, what is the ideal science experiment that you would do?
That's such a good question.
Yeah.
Mark, I want to know.
I mean, in a world that is completely not impacted by resource limitations, not impacted by time, you know, I would build a city. I would geotag everything within the city so I could account for point sources of various things like homes that contained lead, e-vehicles, internal combustion vehicles, etc., and then create a very large scale fire in a mock city and see what happens.
You'd burn it down.
That's, you know, that's not a practical approach.
Do you do this on a smaller scale in your lab?
We do try to recreate scenarios that are associated with various fire fuels. But one of the biggest challenges with lab scale reconstructions is that it is literally a matter of scale. So things like temperature of combustion or combustion efficiencies are difficult to impossible to recreate at a small scale.
Mark, do you have any cleanup tips for people who are, you know, going back to their house and maybe there's ash around or they're near an affected site? What should they do?
One of the kind of critical things that I would do myself would be using a as highly rated air filtration system as my HVAC system could deal with. So MERV 13 or better. And I would engage in cleaning practices that were not stirring things up. So mopping would be better than using a broom, for instance. But the ultimate answer is that there isn't a very clear criteria to establish how you clean all things all of the time.
When do you think we'll start having some answers? And what should people be doing in the meantime?
I think over the next few weeks, because a lot of people are mobilizing, and I'm so glad I met Mark through Science Friday, because I will need your help, please, and expertise as well, and I'll reach out. But I think over the next few weeks, you'll start to see data coming out. I want to say in the meantime, though, there's so much good practical information out there on how to clean, how to be safe. Listen to people you trust. Don't panic. But if you're in impacted areas, try to be safe about these things. If you're in a general area that's not as impacted, you can go about your day-to-day life and hopefully try to help as much as you can with anyone around you who needs help.
Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Rima Haber, an associate professor of environmental health and spatial sciences at the University of Southern California in LA, and Dr. Mark Wilson, director of exposure science at the Chemical Insights Research Institute in Marietta, Georgia. After the break, what samples from the asteroid Bennu are revealing about the origin of life. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. About 4.5 years ago, a spacecraft called OSIRIS-REx landed on the surface of an asteroid called Bennu. It drilled down and scooped up samples of rock and dust, and after several years of travel, delivered those samples back to Earth. Since then, researchers around the world have been analyzing tiny bits of that asteroid dust, trying to tease out as much information as they can about what Bennu is like and where it might have come from. Two scientific papers published this week give some results of those experiments. Joining me now are Dr. Danny Glavin, senior scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and co-investigator on the OSIRIS-REx asteroid sample return mission, and Dr. Dante Loretta, planetary scientist at the University of Arizona and leader of the OSIRIS-REx mission. He's also the author of Asteroid Hunter. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah.
You two know each other, I gather.
Yeah, actually, Dante and I met 22 years ago where we shared a tent in Antarctica as part of the ANSMET meteorite hunting expedition, and actually together discovered this rock, a meteorite from space, that had liquid water on it, which was clearly a sign of contamination. So even in the most pristine environment on Earth, meteorites can still be contaminated. And this is where the idea for OSIRIS-REx was born.
Yeah, it was a really profound moment. Danny was well known for studying a famous Martian meteorite that had been found in Antarctica called Allen Hills 84001. That made quite an impact in the community when a group of scientists from NASA's Johnson Space Center speculated that it might contain signs of life on Mars. And he was really agitated by the water. And I remember vividly him saying, amino acids could be exchanging with the meteorite right now. It felt like finding a treasure only to realize that it was all counterfeit. And that's when I think we both realized if we really want to pursue this science of understanding the origin of life and the role these carbon-rich asteroids play, we're going to have to go out and get some ourselves.
Wow. So this, what we're talking about today was really born 22 years ago in a tent in Antarctica.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've been working together ever since.
Dante, fast forward 22 years. Remind us what Bennu is and why we wanted to go there.
Bennu is a near-Earth asteroid, which means its orbit comes very close to that of the Earth. And it's somewhat infamous for being known as the most potentially hazardous asteroid. And that is not a coincidence, because when we were designing a mission to go to an asteroid and collect a sample, we needed something that was relatively close to the Earth, dynamically speaking. And Bennu has an orbit that really facilitates this kind of round trip that we went on. But our science, and especially the science that Danny is the expert in, was going after organic molecules. And this asteroid dates back from the dawn of our solar system, over 4.5 billion years ago, and it contains a geologic record of organic molecular evolution, and it was the reason it rose to the top of our list when we were going through candidate selection for the mission target.
How much of Bennu were you able to scoop up? Like, how much mucky dust are we talking about? A pasta pot's worth? A coffee mug's worth?
Oh, we're talking about a cupful, 120 grams of material, which, by the way, was twice our requirement. So the science team was excited to get that much material. I know it doesn't sound like much, but this is going to enable analyses for decades to come. It's a bounty of material. And again, truly, this sample is a gift that we'll keep on giving.
Okay, once the samples were back, what happened next? How did you start to analyze them?
Yeah, so we took some of this sample, very small amount, a few tens of milligrams, and we basically boiled it in water. We made a Bennu tea, so we literally made the tea. And then we analyzed the extract using several different types of mass spectrometers to really look at the masses of the individual compounds in this tea. And we found right away that it was this complex soup of organic molecules, incredible, almost 10,000 nitrogen-bearing organic molecules, so super complex. And among that, we found 14 of the 20 protein amino acids in life on Earth, and also all 5 nucleobases that make up the genetic code in DNA and RNA.
Is that a big deal?
It's a very big deal, yes.
It's a huge deal. And what makes this so important is that we're detecting these in a pristine sample. So many of these compounds have been found before in meteorites, like the one Dante and I were looking at in Antarctica, but they've been compromised, both from atmospheric entry heating, but also biology on the Earth. So with the Bennu samples, they were protected from the heat during atmospheric entry. They were protected from the terrestrial biota, the biosphere. And so we can trust these results. I mean, we're fully confident, finally, in these detections of the building blocks of life.
So this is like exactly the problem that you pointed out in Antarctica, that it was counterfeit. You now do not have that problem.
Correct.
Yeah, that's right. And that was really the whole motivation for the mission. And, you know, it only took us 22 years to realize that dream.
Yeah, this is definitely not a sprint. It's not a sprint. This is a marathon.
It's a career commitment, absolutely, yeah, when you sign up for a project of this magnitude.
Was there anything in that sample that surprised you?
Yeah, there's several things for me. One of the things we noticed right away when we poured out the sample from the collector in the lab at Johnson Space Center was that most of the material is really dark and black. And it's actually hard to describe it. When you see photos of it, they're stretched so you can see some of the contrast. But when you see with your eye, it doesn't look quite real. It's so dark, it looks like a hole in the deck that it's sitting on there. But some of the particles are really bright and white, and they draw your eye immediately to them. And we were very excited because they look like salt. And that's a companion paper that's coming out in Nature along with Danny's organic study, is that we have evaporite minerals, minerals that formed from a large body of salty water that evaporated away and left these salt crystals behind. And they're beautiful crystals. They're not just embedded in the clays. They're growing into what look like void spaces. So they've got beautiful bladed structures, the kind of thing mineral collectors dream about for their collection because they're so stunning just in their appearance.
What does it mean to have these salts in there?
It means that Bennu came from a very wet world, and I dare to speculate maybe even something like an ocean world. You know, we're very interested in these objects of the outer solar system, like Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, or Enceladus, which is orbiting around Saturn, because they have icy crusts with deep bodies of liquid water underneath them. We can't say that it's quite that extensive of a system, but it had to be very large in spatial scale, at least kilometers across. And some of Danny's results actually confirm that Bennu's material must have originally formed at least maybe as far as Saturn is orbiting today.
Yeah, this is actually one of the big surprises was the high amounts of ammonia. Now, ammonia is important for many biological processes as part of the nitrogen cycle. It's volatile. And so the fact that we're seeing such high amounts meant that this stuff had to have formed way out in a colder region of the solar system, far from the sun, where ammonia ice is stable. And I'll also add that the ammonia was also exciting because this is an important chemical precursor, a building block needed for the formation of amino acids and the nucleobases in DNA and RNA. So the fact that we were seeing it in Bennu at such high levels, just to give you an idea, the amount's about 100 times the levels of ammonia that you might find in your backyard soil. So there's a significant amount there. And again, as Dante noted, this kind of points towards outer solar system origin of some of these ices.
Danny, any other surprises in these building blocks of life? Things you did see or didn't see, things that were unusual?
Yeah. So for me, the biggest kind of surprise was related to this property called handedness or chirality of amino acids. So amino acids come in two forms, left-handed and right-handed. Non-superimposable mirror images. So if you take a hand in your palm, you put it palms down on top of each other, your thumbs stick out. Amino acids have that same property. And all life on Earth uses only the left-handed form in proteins, not the right-handed form. And it's always been a mystery why that happened. Why did life turn left? Now, we've been studying meteorites for decades, and we found that some meteorites, especially ones that had compositions similar to Bennu, had excesses of the left-handed form, up to 60% more than the right-handed form. And so this was kind of hinting at maybe an early solar system bias towards left-handed amino acids, which is why life turned left. Mm. So I was expecting that when we got these Bennu samples back, that we would also see these left-handed excesses, but we didn't. They were equal mixtures of the left and right-handed form. And I remember when we were first looking at the data, I was like, oh my God, I felt pretty discouraged, actually. I'm like, wow, this is 20 years of my research, you know, I can just flush down the toilet.
because you'd been working on the left-handed hypothesis.
Yeah, we had this left-handed hypothesis. But again, this is exactly why we explore right? This is exactly why we do missions like OSIRIS-REx, so we can get closer to the truth.
Yeah, it's also good news to me because it really convinces the team that these are not contaminations from biology.
100%.
Because if it was biologically contaminated, it would be exclusively the left-handed versions. So we've done a good job of keeping the sample pristine all the way to Danny's labs and his team's labs to show that. So it's, for me, it's good news because a big part of the challenge of the mission was preventing anything from Earth from contaminating this.
What kind of crazy precautions did you have to take to prevent the sample from being contaminated?
I think the one that drove the engineering team the craziest was we prohibited them from using nylon when they were assembling the spacecraft. And they couldn't believe the request. And we went into the clean room where they assemble these vehicles. And I don't remember, Danny, how many different nylon components we pointed to and said, you got to get rid of that. You got to get rid of this. You can't have this in the lab. You got to find an alternate. And they were like, this is crazy. How are we going to do this? And then we sat them down and we explained the science. And they got really excited. And they're like, okay, it's a challenge. But they were up for it. And as we've just shown, it's turned out to be incredibly successful.
Yeah, just to follow up, nylon will break down to form amino acids, which is why it was such a big concern to eliminate it.
So just big picture here, does finding these building blocks of life change the way we think about how life might have evolved on Earth? Does it suggest that Bennu or a Bennu sibling could have brought these building blocks of life or brought life to Earth? How does it impact our big picture?
I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, what we're finding with the Bennu samples and detecting these building blocks of life in Bennu suggests that asteroids like Bennu and other materials could have delivered the raw ingredients necessary for the emergence of life, not only on Earth, but elsewhere. I mean, we're also finding these things were spread across the solar system. So as we go look for life elsewhere on Mars or Enceladus or Europa, we know that these places also had these starting materials. So that's actually very exciting. Just to be clear, we're not finding any evidence for biology on asteroid Bennu. We're seeing the building blocks of life, not life itself. Now, that being said, we know from these analyses that these building blocks could be delivered to other environments, the surface of Mars, incorporated into Enceladus, and those may be environments where you could have had more complex chemical evolution that led to life. So we've got the ingredients, but again, no evidence of detecting actual life in the asteroid Bennu samples.
And for me, that presents a really exciting opportunity because we have clearly some sort of liquid water body interacting with these rocks and producing these interesting organic molecules, but the origin of life didn't occur on Bennu's parent body. So what is missing? What happens that takes that rock and turns it into something that's alive? That's still, to me, the greatest mystery facing science today. And now we have geologic samples that we can do direct comparisons. These rocks from Bennu look a lot like rocks that are forming at the mid-ocean ridge right here on Earth at these famous hydrothermal vents called the White Smokers. And so by doing a comparative analysis between those environments, similar, really interesting carbonate-rich lakes on Earth, we can say this system, it has no biology and we can understand what its signatures are. Let's compare it to something from modern Earth that's rich in biology and then use the difference in those two signals to start scanning the surfaces of Mars, looking at the salts on Europa and Enceladus and saying, does it look like something that formed in the asteroid with no biology or does it look a little more like Earth where we know biology is influencing the different mineral phases that are forming?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a key point, Dante. I mean, these samples are providing a really important chemical baseline for non-life, right? And we call it abiotic baseline. And so as we go to Mars and bring back samples from Mars and explore Europa and Enceladus, we can be looking for different chemical signatures that might be more suggestive of biology.
This has been in the works for decades. What is it like for you all to have these findings start to roll in?
It's sometimes it's hard to believe in my life and what I've been able to do and how privileged I've been to be able to lead a program like this. And the results are surpassing my wildest dreams. So I'm just ecstatic. The team is excited. They're working hard. And I think for me, the most gratifying aspect is there's a lot of early career scientists that are just getting started. And you see the wonder in their eyes when we bring them into the laboratory and we say, hey, here's some rocks that we collected off the surface of an asteroid. Are you interested in helping us analyze them? And they're hooked. And I know we've got them and they're going to go off and do great things.
Danny?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, this entire day, honestly, I've just been pinching myself. I mean, literally, am I living a dream? I mean, this feels like a science fiction story. All the things that had to go right with OREX to get these samples back, the number of people that it took to make this happen. I mean, I can't believe we're here, but we're getting some incredible results, exciting results. We're learning more about, you know, the origin of the solar system and potentially even life itself from these precious samples from Bennu. And as Dante said, we're going to have these for decades to come. I mean, we've actually frozen some of this material in a -80°C freezer that might be opened 50 years from now and studied using instruments that don't even exist today. Mm. I'm so looking forward to the years to come and the new discoveries that come out of these samples.
Do you think that we'll have an answer to some of these big questions about the origin of life, the early solar system within our lifetimes?
I'm optimistic. Yeah, I think, you know, we're getting better at searching for signs of life across our solar system, and especially with extrasolar planetary systems. I think we will find it. It has to be there. My instinct just tells me it can't be isolated to just the Earth. And once that happens, then it'll be a bonanza of scientific insights mm-hmm. and investigation.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same. I mean, we're here. You know, we're a living example that life's possible. The building blocks, the puzzle pieces are everywhere. I think we just need to find the right environment, bring back the right samples. I think sample return, at least in our solar system, has to be part of this equation, because we can, again, bring back these pristine materials, right, and get answers that are closer to the truth. So I'm optimistic as well that we'll find something.
Well, I hope for many more sample returns, including one to Mars. I know that one's hanging in the balance. And thank you both. So fascinating.
Yeah, thank you, Flora. It's been a real pleasure.
Yes, thank you.
Dr. Danny Glavin, senior scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and a co-investigator on the OSIRIS-REx asteroid sample return mission. And Dr. Dante Loretta, planetary scientist at the University of Arizona and leader of the OSIRIS-REx mission. That is it for this hour. Lots of folks helped make this show happen, including
Kathleen Davis,
Diana Plasker,
Beth Ramey,
Danielle Johnson,
Santiago Flores.
Thank you, everybody. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and you can catch us all week long on our podcast. Just look for Science Friday wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. I'm Flora Lichtman. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Later in the hour, we'll check in on some quantum computing advances, plus a new technology that blends bioluminescence with cellular machines to shine some light on how our bodies work. But first, a new study on bipolar disorder, a condition that's characterized by extreme mood swings, including sometimes manic episodes followed by bouts of depression. Despite the fact that bipolar disorder affects 40 million people worldwide, it's often misdiagnosed and its underlying biology isn't fully understood. A new study is filling in some gaps. Researchers looked at the DNA of almost 3 million people and found new regions of the genome associated with the condition. Here to tell us more about what these findings might mean for treatment and our understanding of bipolar disorder is my guest, Dr. Neve Mullins, Assistant Professor of Psychiatric Genomics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. Welcome to Science Friday, Neve.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about what you found in this study.
In this study, we found 298 genomic regions linked to bipolar disorder. So each of these regions is a window into the biology of the disorder. Each one can include many genes, and we did a variety of analyses to map the genetic variants in these regions to particular genes. And this allowed us to identify 36 genes that had robust evidence for their involvement in the disorder.
36 genes. So is that a lot? Was that what you were expecting?
We know that bipolar disorder is very polygenic. So there's no one risk gene, but there's many risk variants throughout the genome that each increase risk by a tiny amount. So we expect that there are many genes involved in risk for the disorder.
Okay, so you found 298 regions associated with 36 genes. Were many of these new? Had we known about them before?
Of these 298 regions, 267 of them have been linked to bipolar disorder for the first time in this study. So it's a fourfold increase in the number of regions that were known previously. And that's thanks to being able to conduct this larger study, including many more participants.
A fourfold increase. Okay, yeah, I mean, I want to understand this. Is that because we've never sampled this many people before, or the sampling methods have gotten better? How do you explain that jump?
It's really driven by the number of participants in the study. So every genetic study is a mixture of signal and noise, and we need enough participants in the study so that signal outweighs the noise and we're able to detect the regions of the genome involved. And since each of these genetic variants confers a very small effect on risk, we needed hundreds of thousands of samples to be able to detect these regions.
Were any of the regions surprising, or were they associated with other things that add up for what we know about bipolar disorder?
Many of the genes that we identified have roles in synaptic signaling, so communication between different cells in the brain. And we did also see in this study some evidence of the involvement of certain cell types outside of the brain. So we saw two cell types highlighted from the intestine and the pancreas. And so this was a novel finding for the first time, pointing us towards some cell types outside of the brain. And we do know some of these cell types are capable of producing serotonin, which affects circulating serotonin and brain serotonin levels. So it's pointing us towards an involvement of the gut-brain axis, but we do need further research to better understand the potential mechanism underlying this.
Wow, so the pancreas and the intestines might be involved in bipolar disorder?
Yes, this is what the current data suggests. A link there between the gut-brain axis, which was a surprising finding from this study. It's not something that had come up previously in our previous genetic studies of the disorder. So there's definitely something novel there to explore in future studies.
Are all these genetic regions sort of equally predictive for the illness?
Some of them increase risk for the disorder more than others. So one of the ways these genetic studies could have an impact is in building genetic risk predictors for bipolar disorder or polygenic risk scores. So these are scores that summarize an individual's genetic risk for bipolar disorder based on the results of this study. And so the genetic regions can increase risk by different amounts. But really, we want to look at the risk across the entire genome, and we sum that together to create a polygenic risk score, which is a single number which summarizes a person's genetic risk for the disorder.
And are there multiple presentations of bipolar disorder, and do they correlate somehow with these different regions? If you have changes in different regions, do you have a different presentation of the condition?
We know that bipolar disorder is heterogeneous clinically. So there are different presentations. For example, there are subtypes. Type 1 bipolar disorder is characterized by manic episodes and depressive episodes, whereas type 2 bipolar disorder is characterized by hypomanic episodes and depressive episodes. So we also see some differences on the genetic level. We've been able to study type 1 and type 2 bipolar disorder separately. And what we see is that they're highly genetically similar, but they're not genetically identical. So some differences on the genetic level could partially explain the differences in clinical presentations for people who experience bipolar disorder.
So let's talk about the applications for this research. And you touched on them a little bit, but do you see this research underpinning a new genetic test for diagnosing bipolar disorder?
We won't be able to use a genetic test to diagnose bipolar disorder because it's not completely genetic. So when we think about genetic tests, we need to think about them as tests for a genetic risk or a genetic susceptibility. Currently, the genetic risk predictors that we're able to construct based on genetic studies, they're not yet powerful enough to be used in clinical practice. But we do know that the performance of these genetic risk predictors will continue to improve as we conduct larger and more powerful genetic studies. And so there are a number of possibilities in the long term for being able to use tests for genetic risk in clinical practice. And there are some studies ongoing incorporating genetic risk predictors into clinical care, particularly for physical disorders such as breast cancer or heart disease, to investigate how useful these genetic risk predictors could be in terms of stratifying patients who would benefit from earlier screening or earlier intervention to reduce their risk. So I expect that we'll see more studies in psychiatry in the next few years to investigate how useful polygenic risk scores could be in informing clinical care in terms of assisting with the diagnosis, early intervention, perhaps even treatment selection, alongside the current clinical tools.
Do these findings point to new treatments?
Yes, we've seen, based on the 36 genes that we identified in this study, that many of the proteins encoded by these genes can be targeted by drugs. Some are actually the targets of existing medications that are currently in use for treating other disorders. So there could be opportunities for repurposing some medications for treating bipolar disorder, and there could be some novel drug targets amongst these genes. Of course, we need further research into each of these drug targets, of course, clinical trials before any new medications could be used in patient care. But the results so far are promising, and we know that drugs that have genetic support for their target or their mechanism of action have a higher chance of success in the drug development pipeline. So that's encouraging.
If we zoom out for a minute, how well understood is bipolar disorder?
Until recent years, our knowledge about the genetics of bipolar disorder has lagged behind other psychiatric disorders like schizophrenia or autism, which receive more attention and more research funding. But in the last few years, that's really started to change. Our studies on bipolar disorder have rapidly grown to now including hundreds of thousands of participants, which has enabled us to identify these 298 genomic regions involved. So it's slightly surpassed similar genetic studies on schizophrenia, and our knowledge base on the genetics and biology has really started to improve in the last couple of years.
Why has it lagged behind?
It's received less attention, less research funding than some other psychiatric disorders. The studies on bipolar disorder were smaller than those of other psychiatric disorders. And coming back to that heterogeneity that you mentioned in clinical presentation, again, we need really large sample sizes in order for the signal to outweigh the noise in the genetic studies and be able to detect these regions that are involved in the disorder. So it's really a combination of increasing sample size through international collaboration. In this study, we meta-analyzed the results from 79 different studies from all around the world. So it's bringing together all of that data through international collaboration, having more funding to be able to do this work, has really driven the knowledge forward.
Does stigma around mental illness and around this disorder prevent us from doing these studies, or has it contributed to the lag in our understanding of them?
Yes, there's certainly stigma still surrounding psychiatric disorders. But I think that, you know, understanding the genetics and biology of these disorders could actually contribute to reducing the stigma surrounding them. So having a better understanding of how these conditions arise, and participants in these studies often find it very meaningful to be involved in the research. Even if it doesn't impact them directly right now, it may have impact in the future for other patients. And so contributing to these genetic studies is a way that I think we can reduce the stigma surrounding bipolar disorder, and other psychiatric disorders.
That's about all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Neve Mullins, Assistant Professor of Psychiatric Genomics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. We have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take a look at what's new in quantum computing. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Quantum computing. We keep seeing these exciting new headlines about breakthroughs, like just in the last few months. Google announced that its quantum computer solved a math problem in 5 minutes that would have taken a normal supercomputer longer than the age of the universe to solve. Microsoft told businesses to buckle up because we're on the cusp of seeing quantum computers solve meaningful problems. So, are we on the cusp? Up next, we're doing a quantum computer check-in. What advancements are at the top of the queue? Which can we throw in the cube bin? Here to parse the news is Dr. Shohini Ghosh, a quantum physicist and professor of physics and computer science at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Canada, and CTO of the Quantum Algorithms Institute. Dr. Ghosh, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Okay, before we get to the recent news, can you give us a refresher on what quantum computing is in a way that will not break my brain?
I'll do my best. So quantum computing is a very interesting and revolutionary approach to doing computing. So I think we're all familiar by now with regular computers, which are actually quite simple machines. Essentially, they're just a bunch of switches turning on and off inside. If you look at your circuit board, all of those circuits are really just ways to convert all of our information that we're inputting into, you know, a sequence of zeros and ones, binary digits or bits. So in that sense, it's a very, very simple machine. And we're kind of lucky that everything can be converted into just some sequence of zeros and ones. Turns out that quantum computing is a broader paradigm for computing, where we don't restrict ourselves just to specific values of zeros and ones, but we operate in this very strange new landscape where we allow for some possibility that the quantum bit or qubit is in a state of zero, or some possibility that it's in a one. And so it's kind of like exploring a much larger landscape of all these in-between combination of possibilities of zeros and ones, like 80% zero, 20% one, which all may sound like it's, you know, getting confusing and there's a lot of uncertainty in it.
Right. This is where the brain breaking begins.
Exactly. So don't worry. This is actually quite counterintuitive compared to what we normally do think about computing, which is what makes it, on one hand, confusing, but on the other hand, powerful. Mm. So the what has happened in recent years is this shifting of how we approach this idea of uncertainty and, you know, looking at that entire spectrum of possibilities between zero and one. And if we're very clever, we can build these pathways through this computational landscape to reach the answer faster based on being able to control these possibilities, what we call superpositions of zeros and ones. So in a way, you might think of it like having this probability wave that flows through your problem landscape. And if you can control the wave, you get to your answer actually faster. Sometimes flowing to your answer is actually faster than jumping discretely using zeros and ones. So maybe that helps to try to visualize this very peculiar new framework.
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean, and is the result that a computer can do sort of multiple calculations at once? If a bit can be more than just a zero or a one, if it's more than the binary, does that mean it can sort of explore different pathways at the same time?
Yeah, but I want to be careful there. I know that often quantum computing is described as exploring all possible values all at the same time. Yes, we're in a sense, that's true. This because, of course, when we say superposition, it's that idea of more than one possibility at the same time. However, when we get to the final answer, the trick is that you can only eventually get to the one solution, right? Which is some particular specific string of zeros and ones, which is your final answer. It's not enough just to calculate everything and all possibilities at once, because the final answer then could be any one of those possibilities. So the key is that yes, you explore all these possibilities, but you have to explore them cleverly, not just leave it at, oh, you can do it all at once. Because if you do it all at once, then you might get any one of those possibilities. And there are many more wrong outcomes than there are correct ones. Ah. So there's more to the game.
What do quantum computers look like? Like, what should I picture when we're talking about them?
Well, I think if you Google quantum computers, the one image that comes up a lot, you'll see, is a very amazing, sort of very different kind of image. It doesn't look like a computer. It looks more like this golden chandelier. And that is a particular type of quantum computer that's being built by companies like IBM and Google and others around the world. But most of what you're actually seeing in the image is all of the control and the electronics and the cooling systems you need to operate the processor. The processor itself is actually quite small. It's a small little chip that is very hard to see. So that's one image of a quantum computer. There are others, but none of them look like our current laptops.
Let's check in on some of these recent advances. So in December, Google announced that its quantum computer solved this problem that would take existing supercomputers, you know, longer than the age of the universe to solve, which sounds very cool. Is it cool?
It is definitely cool, but there's always a bit of a but. It's cool in the sense that as a researcher myself, it's exciting because this is a standard benchmark math problem that is used to try to understand the performance of quantum computers. So in that benchmarking test, Google did show that they were able to solve the problem very fast. And the reason this benchmark is used, this particular math problem, because it is actually very hard, even for supercomputers, to solve the problem. And it's not really a solving of a problem. This benchmark problem is actually a way to try to sample random numbers. And turns out that's quite difficult for supercomputers to do. Whereas Google was able to complete that task quite fast, but it is, in fact, a made-up math problem. It's not like solving that problem actually leads to any particular useful real-world application, like, you know, maybe helping to design better molecules for chemistry materials design, for example, or, you know, some kind of a healthcare drug development things. So that level of real-world application is not there yet. So on one hand, it is exciting, but on the other hand, it's not real-world.
Okay, it's not real world. Were there any other pieces to that advance that signaled we are in a new phase of quantum computing?
Yeah, one other very exciting aspect of that announcement was that Google was able to address this question that comes up a lot, and it's one of the biggest challenges for quantum computing development, and that is the question of errors. So quantum computers actually are very, very difficult to control precisely because even the smallest disturbance will throw it off and there'll be errors in the computation. It's kind of like our regular computers. You know, these days we don't see it much, but there used to be those overheating problems and computers sometimes freeze up even today.
Yes, the fan goes on and you're just, and then nothing works anymore. Yes.
Exactly. So with quantum computers, a problem is infinitely worse. For example, Google's machine and IBM's machine, these computers have to be cooled down to temperatures that are colder than outer space. Wow. So even the tiniest amount of heating causes errors. And it's not just a heat question. Anything that interacts with this quantum processor will throw it off. So they're very, very fragile. What Google did that's exciting is that they used this framework that we call quantum error correction, where you can actually take each of these individual quantum bits or qubits, and by coupling all these qubits together, you can, in a sense, reduce the error as you add more and more qubits. Normally, you would think that the errors would go up because there's even more qubits. They're all going to have errors, and that'll multiply. But there's this clever framework where you can actually reduce error correction as long as each of the qubits has a particular threshold of error and failure. So what Google was able to show is that as you increase the number of qubits, you can actually reduce the error. And obviously, that's a very important piece of being able to scale up and build large-scale quantum computers. So that was very exciting.
Why are companies like Google and Microsoft and IBM working on quantum computing? I mean, is this akin to sort of like the race to develop AI, where these companies want to own the market because quantum computing could be applied to a million bazillion things and we can't even dream up the applications yet. Like, is that the right analogy or is there something else going on?
Well, yeah, in the end, quantum computers can unlock huge performance advantages in certain types of areas. So one of the key applications which kind of kickstarted this whole field was to solve this one math problem, which sounds kind of like a fairly simple problem, and that's factoring. Meaning if I take a number like 15 and ask, can you find the factors? Well, that's easy. That's 3 times 5. But if you go to numbers that are, let's say, 100 or 200 digits long, even our supercomputers have a hard time cracking that problem. And this is an important problem because hard math is actually what keeps all of our information safe because it's at the foundation of encryption systems. So, for example, if a hacker wants to hack your passwords, actually that encryption is based on factoring. So the hacker would have to know how to factor large numbers. And turns out that's computationally hard, and that's what keeps our information safe. Turns out quantum computers can actually solve a problem like factoring exponentially fast. So this is actually what got everybody to wake up and say, oh my gosh, if you can build that kind of large-scale quantum computer, you actually can basically read everybody's secrets and hack into passwords and, you know, find out about people's finances and healthcare records and things like this. So that's one of these big, big applications. And that has led to this race around the world to try to be the first to get there. But that's only one. There's other possible applications, as I was saying, in developing drugs and, you know, doing the simulations you need to understand molecules and quantum chemistry. There's also applications in being able to solve optimization problems, such as, you know, trying to get the best sort of supply chain, right? That's an example of an optimization problem that we see all the time around the world. So there are definitely many areas where quantum can benefit. But it's not that it's going to replace everything that we do with our regular computers.
I know the US and China are both spending billions on quantum research. What do you make of this?
Well, you're right that there's definitely a lot of funding. And in fact, there's more than US and China. I'd say as of the last count, there's been over 30 different governments in the world that have announced national quantum strategies. And I think the reason there is because it's recognized as something that is very critical to the security of countries. So it is related to sovereignty and security of data.
Do you see this as a type of arms race?
I think, yes, it is very similar to what we've seen historically with arms races because it can be used. Absolutely, it can be weaponized, this technology. Governments are racing to build out plans because it's not just about having the technology to deploy, but also to be able to defend against the technology being deployed against their own citizens. So in that sense, absolutely, there's a lot of similarities with an arms race.
You know, we've been talking about encryption and state security. Do you see quantum computers changing my life, changing our listeners' lives in meaningful ways?
Yeah, so quantum is not really a technology that's going to replace our current computers because honestly, our laptops are just fine for almost everything that we do on an everyday level. It's not like I wake up every day and need to solve a complicated molecule problem. So right. If I'm doing email, my laptop is just fine. But even with email, what will be impacted going forward is that on the back end, every time we send email, we are sending encrypted data. So the encryption on the back end will start to change and we will be shifting over to what we call post-quantum encryption, which is a way to try to protect against future hacking by quantum computers. And eventually we'll be sending data through what we call quantum networks, where our information is actually being encoded using quantum information built into qubits. And just like we don't see the encryption running on our current computers, we probably won't see it going forward on our laptops and devices, but it will be there. So it will be impacting us. We just perhaps will not see it every day.
Are people using quantum computers outside of the lab? Like, are they outside of the demo space at this point?
For the most part, they're still in development. However, there are certain areas in which there is already what we call real-world, ready-to-use kind of potential applications that there are companies that are accessing this. So, for example, there's a company called D-Wave, which offers a quantum device that is actually very much tailored to do one type of problem, and that is optimization kinds of problems. Everything is an optimization problem at some level. So, like I was mentioning earlier, if, for example, you wanted to find the best routing system for your delivery trucks, they have a very, very complicated algorithm that they need to run to be able to deliver all of your packages. And you know how we get really annoyed when it doesn't come within the next day? It's actually quite a hard logistical problem. So in the back end, there's always some kind of an algorithm running to try to optimize how all those deliveries work. And that's one example of optimization. So there are companies that have used that tool to actually improve their optimization calculations. So it's happening. It's just not a universal quantum computer. It's specifically for optimization, but it's definitely real world already.
How do you see quantum computing playing with AI and machine learning?
That's a great question. I think the future is really going to be in this hybrid space where both quantum and AI will be applied to whatever is the computational task, where some parts of the task will be done using the quantum processor, some parts will be done using machine learning, so that the combination will provide you with the optimal performance.
I want to come back to where we started. Do you think we're on the cusp of something big with quantum computing?
You know, it's always very hard to predict the future of any technology. I think we've always got it wrong. But given that disclaimer, I will say, as a scientist, yes, I am quite excited in all of the progress that has been made. And I'd say that it's faster than I would have predicted. And I think the big exciting moment will happen when somebody announces, yes, we have solved an actual real world problem. Maybe it's in healthcare, maybe it'll be in finance. My guess is it's going to be in some kind of quantum chemistry problem, which might be applied to material design or biology. And that's, I think, coming. It's in the next few years. I think we're going to see some very exciting announcements.
I really appreciate you walking us through this today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Shohini Ghosh, a quantum physicist and professor of physics and computer science at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Canada, and CTO of the Quantum Algorithms Institute. Coming up next, how researchers are using glowing enzymes from fireflies to better understand how viruses and memories work. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. The inner workings of our bodies and our cells can be kind of a black box. We know that all these itsy bitsy molecules are constantly working and churning to keep us alive, but the details of their comings and goings and interactions can be hazy. But a new technology that blends bioluminescence with cellular machinery may shine some light. Scientists had this bright idea: take that same enzyme that makes fireflies glow and tie it to RNA, the molecule that reads the genetic info in DNA. And the hope is that these light-up molecules can help illuminate how viruses replicate or even how memories form in the brain. Joining me now to tell us more about their research are my guests, Dr. Andre Luptak, professor of pharmaceutical sciences at the University of California, Irvine, and Dr. Jen Prescher, professor of chemistry at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Great to be here.
Okay, Andre, refresh our memories. Remind us quickly what RNA does.
Well, RNA is the first molecule that gets made as the genetic information that's encoded in DNA is executed. And the first thing that would happen if you say, okay, go do this, go do that, that on the molecular level, what you're doing is you're expressing an RNA, you're making an RNA molecule. So it's the first act of gene expression.
So I think of RNA kind of like the middle manager, like it takes direction from the DNA and then it delegates, right, to the cellular machinery that will make it happen. Is that the right analogy?
Yeah, that's a really good way to think about it. But it has its own functions in its own right. Sometimes it catalyzes chemical transformation. Sometimes it acts in regulating other cellular processes.
So you attached this little lantern to it. Is that the right way to think about it, Jen?
That's absolutely right. We took a well-known light-emitting system in nature, these bioluminescent probes, which comes from a luciferase reaction with a luciferin small molecule, and that creates light. And we use those components and drag them to RNAs of interest. And so when the RNA was produced, we had the light-emitting enzyme dragged to it, and we could see light production relevant to the presence of the RNA itself.
How long does that little firefly lantern stay on? Like, is it on indefinitely?
In the first system that we produced, we designed the lantern to stay on for the lifetime of the RNA. So whenever the RNA was present, the light would be there. And whenever it wasn't, we would see no light.
How do you know that the lantern isn't messing up the function of the RNA, isn't sort of like getting in the way or mucking up what the RNA does?
The key aspect of our work was to design and then optimize a tiny, tiny, tiny RNA that is a module. And we spent a good 2 years making sure that it's independent of other parts of other RNA. So it's basically a little solid rock that the luciferase binds. We don't have any evidence that that part of the RNA interferes with any other function of a longer RNA that it may be part of or another RNA in the cell.
So you popped it on a place on the RNA that's not doing anything else.
That's right.
Okay. And so why RNA? Like, why illuminate its comings and goings?
The scientists have been illuminating many aspects of the cell for many years. For RNAs is a couple of decades behind what other areas of particularly studying proteins has been doing. And so it was simply a gap that we wanted to fill because we had questions about where RNA was produced, when it was produced, and where it was going. And we wanted to understand this on levels from basically single molecule all the way to a living mouse.
What does this look like? Like, what's the readout of this? Can you help me picture it in my mind?
The light emission that we're using here isn't bright enough to see with your own eyes at this level, but we use really sensitive cameras, similar to those that are used by astronomers and so forth, to collect every last little photon coming out of a given system. And those then create a snapshot of the lantern and the associated RNA at a given time.
Are you saying that we're using sort of like telescope technology to look inside the body?
Absolutely. There's different ways of thinking about how to observe things. And the telescope analogy here is a good one because we're trying to put the largest lens we can over our experiment and then and then essentially tie it to a very, very sensitive camera.
What are the questions you're excited to investigate with this new technology?
Oh my, that's another part of our, every week something else comes up. We would like to know when, in a live mouse, when a memory forming event takes place and then RNA is expressed that is related to that memory formation.
Wait, you're going to have to back up. A memory forming event?
Well, it's something that a mouse would remember.
How is RNA related to that? You know, I think we think of neurons and synapses, but tell me how RNA plays a role or might play a role.
Well, in all events that are meant to leave a lasting effect, so that would be a memory, RNA is involved because you, in a neuron, an RNA is made to then code for a protein that is involved in, for example, strengthening of a synapse, right? So ultimately, the synapse may be built out of a membrane and membrane proteins, but the information that codes for it is delivered locally via an RNA. And neurons are particularly interesting because they're large. They're huge cells. It's a long way from a nucleus to a synapse in certain neurons. And so there is a lot of questions related to transport levels of expression? How does it find its way? When does it go there? We have answers to these questions from cell culture experiments that has been done over the past, almost about three decades. But in a live organism, we have not seen that. We would really love to.
It sounds like RNA are sort of making the tiniest building blocks of memories, and this technology would allow you to sort of see those blocks being placed. Is that a sound about right?
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. We think of it more of a how the information is moved from the nucleus where the DNA is stored. And, you know, you've parked your car today. You want to find your car when you come back.
So could this technology be used to help us make better mRNA vaccines, for example?
We believe so. We think anytime you have a tool, a molecular tool that lets you visualize something fundamental, a key technology where you know where you're putting it, at what point does it enter the cell? You know, how quickly does it enter the cell? And ideally, which cells are affected? You know, we can then use that as a tool to build better vaccines and deliver the mRNAs to places more precisely, for example.
What about viruses? I mean, they're made of RNA often, right? Could you add your lantern to a virus?
Absolutely. The lanterns can report on RNAs from not just, you know, human cells, but also those from different viruses. And we're very much interested in being able to use the lanterns and different colors of lanterns to be able to track the spread of different viruses in models to learn more about the underlying biology and potentially then ways to treat infection.
So that would be revolutionary, right? Being able to watch a virus move through the body?
Right. Being able to watch the spread of viral infection over the whole organism would provide some novel insights into the spread of infectious disease and things that we might not even realize are happening. And that then leads to better avenues for treatment.
How long did it take to get this to work? Why are you laughing?
This project was sort of years in the making. Andre and I have been colleagues at UC Irvine for almost 15 years now, and these have been sort of ideas that have been percolating, I think, over the entire 15-year period. And within the past 5 years or so, we really started to focus on this aspect of using luciferases to tag RNAs. Andre is an expert in RNA biology, and I have done a lot with developing luminescence technologies over the years. And so that was sort of a natural fit. But there was so many things that needed to be optimized to pull off these types of experiments, from designing the RNAs to designing the lantern proteins to developing the small molecules and the instrumentation and analyzing cells and whole organisms. So we really needed a whole kind of dream team of people also to come together, including one of our close collaborators on this project, Oz Steward from the neurobiology department here at UC Irvine. And then we also had a really outstanding team of students that got this project off the ground. And I think without them, we couldn't have spanned this highly interdisciplinary area to pull this off. What do you think, Andre?
I agree. And the one other thing was about 9-10 years ago, we started writing proposals to get this funded, to get it going. And it was a struggle for a while. You know, it took time to both assemble the team and find the support for it.
Well, I want to ask about that. It was a struggle because it was basic research, or because people didn't see the value, or people didn't think it was going to work. What was the struggle?
I think people didn't think it would work. Well, we know that because we got the reviews.
They told you.
You know, we early on, some of the reviews we got were, well, you guys will never have enough photons to see what you think you will see. You know, it's challenging to convince others that are used to looking at a much stronger signal that we will see what we think we will see, and it'll be in real time. With good spatial resolution. And ultimately, that's what ended up happening. But it took a while.
What did it feel like when it did start working?
Oh, it was amazing.
It was awesome, yeah.
You know, in some ways, we got I wouldn't say lucky, but we had a hint that it was going to work right when we finally had the team assembled. When we started working on this in earnest, we had a smidget of a signal that we called it the 1.2 day.
Yes.
And it was the signal of our background was 1.2. So you can imagine it wasn't much.
That's a very scientist way of saying like, very little was coming through, right?
Very little was coming through. And, you know, we were reasonably convinced that, yes, that signal is real. And so let's just work on it. Let's optimize. Let's engineer this. Let's hit it from every angle. And, you know, that 1.2 turned into about 400 or 500 ultimately. The effort led to about 100-fold improvement.
Yeah, I would definitely say that every week it seems like there's some exciting eureka moment with the images and things that we've been generating. And this group gets together every Friday to go over the latest. And I think that feeling of excitement that came from the 1.2-fold measurement early on, that has sustained itself through all of these weekly meetings over the years.
Are people knocking down your door to get a hold of this, other scientists?
We certainly had people reach out to acquire the different sequences and the different lantern components that we've been using. One of the most fun things about being involved in imaging tool and technology development is to see just how far and wide it is applied and the new insights it can bring beyond the applications that we're performing in our own lab.
What's next for you two?
More photons. We're very, very excited about this. And some of the experiments that we described, you know, including with RNA viruses, with mRNA delivery, and in particular in neurobiology, in neurons, those are the key areas where we're working on.
When do you think we're going to start seeing sort of new discoveries using this tech? Like when do you expect we might learn more about how memories are formed or start tracing viruses in the body?
Well, I think the viral work can be quite quick. It's really just putting these tools into the viral the RNA and then doing fairly standard virology experiments. So, you know, it depends on how well it works, but that should be months. The questions related to neurobiology tend to be slower. I think we're looking at some couple of years.
The brain's a complicated place.
Sure.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Andre Luptak, Professor of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of California, Irvine, and Dr. Jen Prescher, Professor of Chemistry at the University of California, Irvine. Before we go, last week on the show, we talked about the winter doldrums and how to do winter better. And you all had a lot to say. We got calls from around the country.
My name is Sal Thorkelson. I live in Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
This is Ali Lee from Hawaii.
Hi, this is Daniel from Chicago.
You winter lovers were out in force with your tips and tricks and some perspective shifts for how to get through the coldest, darkest days.
My favorite day of the year is December 22nd because that is the day that the days start getting lighter and lighter every single day. So that's my biggest celebration day. And that helps me.
You don't really need coping mechanisms for the winter. You just go cross-country skiing every day. That's what I do.
Also being a surfer and the winter being the season when the surf comes, we look forward to winter every year.
Hi, Science Friday. I live in Norway and it's so dark here and it's so cold. I have a lamp. Quite a large lamp that I have on a time clock, and that comes on and that totally lights up the whole bedroom like so much. And it's a bit of a shock, but I can hide myself under the duvet for a bit. But then after a short time, I'm wide awake. And this is my survival in the winter time.
We also floated this idea of rebranding winter, you know, like forget the winter doldrums, the winter blues. Instead, we need a pro-winter catchphrase. And I wanted to share one of my favorite submissions.
Well, it seems absolutely clear to me that it needs to be January jollies and February follies. No doubt.
No doubt.
This is Christopher Parks. I'm from Somerset, New Jersey.
Thanks, Christopher, and to everyone who called. And if you have a message for us or a question about winter things or any other things, give us a call. Our number is 646-767-6532. 646-767-6532. We always want to hear from you. You can also email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. Find us all week long on our podcast, Every Day is Science Friday, on iTunes and Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts. Have a festive, folly-filled February Eve, and we'll see you next week. I'm Flora Lichtman.